Hello, future personal trainers, and welcome to one of the most important chapters in the entire NASM Essentials of Personal Fitness Training book. My name is Eddie Lester, and we're looking at Chapter 6, which is fitness assessments, and specifically we're going over the PowerPoint lecture. So we have 66 engaging, fun slides to go over with you, and within those slides, we're going to look at about 20 total questions that come out of the NASM Personal Fitness Training or Essentials of Personal Fitness Training text and on the NASM Certified Personal Trainer text. So let's go ahead and hop on through these, clicking over to slide two. So the objectives for this particular lecture are to understand the relationship between sales and the fitness assessment and its importance in building the value of the personal trainer, understand how to administer a health history questionnaire, and then from that be able to stratify a client's overall risk for fitness assessment, understand the importance of posture, how it relates to movement observation and how to assess it, and understand how to perform a comprehensive health-related fitness assessment, obtain subjective and objective information about clients, and how to use the information collected to help design an exercise program. So clicking over to slide three. So to define a fitness assessment, NASM defines it as a systematic problem-solving method that provides the fitness professional with a basis for making educated decisions about exercise and acute variable selection. And it's not designed to diagnose any condition or anything like heart disease or any sort of diabetes or any diseases. It's there just to observe the client's current status and specifically structural and functional, and create a starting point for them to work from. Basically, it's going to be an idea of where is the client right now and proving to them that they're here right now so that in 3 months, when you get them to their goal, you can say, look, this is where we were about 3 months ago, and now look how far you've come. And specifically, it's also a way to integrate a sales pitch to attempt to get clients to train with you as well, which is, yeah, like they say, integrate sales techniques and utilize a chance to build value into your services. So clicking over to slide four, the components of a fitness assessment. So there's subjective information and objective information. And there is a test question that comes directly from this sort of knowledge of subjective information and objective. So subjective information is going to be anything that the client tells you about themselves. For instance, their history, their medical history, their past injuries, their past surgeries, more or less just what they tell you about themselves as if you didn't observe it, but they just told you. Objective information specifically is assessments that you perform on them and observe the results. So specifically, objective information is physiologic assessments such as heart rate and blood pressure, which is important to know as that's going to be where the main test question comes from. And we also have body composition, cardiorespiratory assessments, static and dynamic postural assessments, and performance assessments. So it's really important to understand the difference in the sense that subjective information, they're just telling you about themselves, and objective information, you're collecting data on their current status. So clicking over to slide five, we're going to go a little bit more specific into subjective information. And like I said, it's going to be gathered from a prospective client to give the fitness professional feedback regarding personal history, such as occupation, lifestyle, and medical background. So it is going to be important to understand what they do for a living, as that could affect their current status and posture as well. For instance, someone that works on a computer all day long might have rounded shoulders and a forward head, which might affect some upper extremity movements during fitness. So one of the easiest forms of gathering this information or subjective information is going to be the PAR-Q, which is going to be directed towards detecting any possible cardiorespiratory dysfunction. And this is typically like a 7-question sheet that they're going to fill out that just makes sure that they haven't had any heart issues, they don't have breathing issues, and anything that could put them at really high risk for, we'll say, fainting or something during the initial, you know, workout or assessment process. So clicking over to slide six, general history is going to be like occupation. So what do they do for a living? How long do they do it for? Do they sit down? Do they stand? Are they a construction worker to where they're working for and doing repetitive movements? And also lifestyle, what do they do for fun? Do they like to ski often? Do they play tennis? There's also information that you can gather from those sort of topics that can assist you in understanding more about the client's functional movement status, as well as how easy it might be for them to get back in shape or different things like that. So specifically, they talk about occupation. Does your occupation require extended periods of sitting? Like I talked about before, if their occupation requires extended periods of sitting, you could potentially have tight hip flexors because the hips is constantly flexed and that shortens the psoas muscle. Or from sitting, you can also get rounded shoulders and forward head. Like I'm sure you're hunching over right now looking at this PowerPoint. And so sit up straight, as grandma would say. But you would potentially, if someone does this for 8 hours a day, you're going to have sort of a forward posture, your shoulders are forward, and head might be even jutting a little bit forward as well. So does your occupation require extended periods of repetitive movements? The specific one that NASM talks about with this is something like a construction worker in which they're working overhead a lot, and potentially could be at risk for something like shoulder impingement syndrome, which we can get into further down the road. Does your occupation require you to wear shoes with a heel or dress shoes? Sometimes a high dress shoe can shorten the gastrocnemius or the calf muscles, and that would potentially make them make their overhead squat a little bit off, or their posture would be off due to tight calves. And Is your occupation mentally stressful? Does it cause anxiety? These factors really matter because when you have a hormonal imbalance due to a ton of stress, such as increased cortisol, that could potentially inhibit their goals to be achieved. And also with stress, you could potentially cause your secondary breathing muscles to tighten. If you've heard of people being stressed, being uptight, that is literally due to the fact that when you are stressed, you breathe differently as opposed to when you are not stressed. And that potentially could shorten muscles that might leave your shoulders slightly elevated or you kind of like uptight. And lifestyle, like I said before, they talk about recreation. What do they do for fun as far as maybe some sports, recreational sports? And then hobbies, maybe, you know, do they like working on cars? Do they like gardening? Are they being active in some of their hobbies and different items like that? So clicking over to slide 7, medical history. Find out a client's medical history to obtain information about life-threatening or chronic diseases, as well as structural and functional health. The main thing with medical history, I'm looking for pain. Do they currently have pain? Is it from a past injury? Is it from a surgery? Or do they have some sort of chronic condition that might limit their ability to exercise with me in any way, such as any sort of heart disease or respiratory dysfunction or even, you know, high blood pressure, things like that. And are they currently on any medications? So let's go ahead and click over to slide 8. The objective information that you're interested in gathering is going to be all of the stuff that's you're going to do the assessment on the client to gather information. So to read the first bullet point, gathered to provide the fitness professional with forms of measurable information. And it can be used to compare beginning numbers to those measured weeks, months, or years later to prove that your client is benefiting from the exercise program. And specifically, those are things like physiologic assessments, such as like heart rate and blood pressure. You have body composition, which could be like body fat or total maybe body circumferences or skin fold measurements. And then you have cardiorespiratory assessments, so how in shape is their heart at pumping blood during exercise. And posture and movement assessments, such as the overhead squat or pushing and pulling assessments. And then we also have things like performance assessments. If they were an athlete, you know, how good are they at certain performance measures? So clicking over to slide 9. So the physiologic assessments, like I mentioned before, heart rate and blood pressure, pretty simple. Heart rate is going to measure in beats per minute. Average resting heart rate is going to be about 70 to 80 beats per minute, or about 75 beats per minute for women and 70 beats per minute in men. And then blood pressure, your average blood pressure that you should expect is 120 over 80. High blood pressure is when you get anything over 140 over 90, just some basic things like that. So clicking over to slide 10, to measure the radial pulse, this is going to be important to understand for the test as this is something that you will do in the field of personal training as well. You want to measure someone's resting heart rate or just heart rate in general during exercise, at rest. You want to be able to take their heart rate. So the radial pulse is where it's done, which is on the thumb side of the hand. And you gently place two fingers along the arm line and just above the thumb. So the radial pulse, you gently place two fingers right there. That's the way that you're going to take blood pressure. And that's specific to what they might ask on the test. And once a pulse is identified, you count the pulses for 30 seconds and multiply it by 2, or you can count the full 60 seconds as the heart rate is measured in beats per minute. And the best way to measure someone's resting heart rate is right after they wake up in the morning, which is actually another potential test question. And you record it for 60 seconds. You're going to have your client take their own pulse right when they wake up for 3 days, and you're going to average that. So that's the best way to get resting heart rate right after waking. So looking on to slide 11, you have more measuring the heart rate. The carotid pulse is going to be a little bit stronger than the radial pulse, but typically you aren't going to really use that on your clients, because if you have someone, you know, jabbing your neck with two fingers, it's not going to be as comfortable as placing two fingers right on their wrist. So the carotid pulse, you're going to lightly place two fingers on the neck just to the side of the larynx, or just to the side of your throat and or Adam's apple. And once the pulse is identified, count the pulse for 30 seconds and multiply by 2. And the best way to measure your resting heart rate is going to be 60 seconds after waking in the morning, which that's would probably be the most appropriate one for your client to use, as it's going to be the strongest. So, looking at average resting heart rate, we already talked about that. Males is about 70 beats per minute. Females is about 75 beats per minute. So, clicking over to slide 12, we're looking at the training heart rate in physiologic assessments. And what you're looking to do with the training heart rate is kind of determine where you can create a cardiorespiratory exercise program for them. So, calculate the client's heart rate training zone for cardiorespiratory exercise. So the best way to find the estimated max heart rate is going to be 220 minus age. And this is called the straight percentage method. And both of those are potential test questions. And I really want you to highlight that, because to find a client's estimated maximal heart rate, 220 minus age. And what do? You take 220 minus age, and then you multiply it by the percentages below for zone 1, zone 2, and zone 3 to find someone's area in which they can exercise as far as cardiorespiratory training goes. And once again, this is called the straight percentage method. So once you do that, you multiply the estimated maximum heart rate by their appropriate intensity. So 65% to 90% is that total intensity, even though you can go all the way up to 95 for zone 3, but typically you're going to stay in that 65 to 90%, as it is really difficult to get someone all the way up to their max heart rate. And to do a simple equation for you, 220 minus age, let's say our client is, you know, 25 years old. Actually, let's go with 20 to make the number simpler. 220 minus age, so their age is 20. 220 minus 20 is 200. And then you can multiply 200 by 65% to get 130, or by 80% to get 160. And you can go with zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, estimate their heart rate right there. So right now I want you to go ahead and pause this and do your estimated max heart rate and your current cardiorespiratory training zones. Good. So I'm glad you did that. Now let's go and click over to slide 13. So more about physiologic assessments. You have blood pressure, which is systolic and diastolic. Systolic is going to be the top number. And that's produced by the heart as it contracts to pump blood through the body. So when you think about a systolic and diastolic numbers, you need to understand that systolic is literally when the heart contracts to pump blood out of the ventricles. And that is going to be a higher pressure, because there's a muscular contraction forcing blood into the arteries. And that pressure is normally about 120 millimeters of mercury, over HG, or mmHg means millimeters of mercury, which is just a way that we measure pressure here on Earth. And diastolic number is going to be a little bit lower, because it's the minimum pressure within the arteries when the heart is resting. And I am pointing this out specifically because they want you to know the difference between systolic and diastolic for the test. And specifically, they're going to ask you about diastolic, or the minimum pressure within the arteries when the heart is resting. And the normal diastolic pressure is going to be 80 millimeters of mercury, or a little bit lower. So 120 over 80, whenever you hear those numbers as far as blood pressure goes, that's going to be normal blood pressure. And that's the difference in the two numbers. Systolic is the top, diastolic is the bottom. Very important to know for the test. So let's go ahead and click over to slide 14. So physiologic assessments. Blood pressure testing, so the way that you do it is going to be you're going to instruct the client to assume a comfortable position and place the appropriate size cuff just below the elbow. Rest the arm on a supported chair, and you can find the brachial artery, which is just on the medial side of the elbow joint, and just on the inside of your bicep. And you, that's where you're going to place the stethoscope. You're going to inflate the blood pressure cuff to about 20 to 30 millimeters of mercury above where the pulse can no longer be felt at the wrist, and then release the pressure at a rate of about 2 millimeters of mercury per second. And that's what the needle is going by, or the ticks on the dial is going to be millimeters of mercury. And so to determine systolic pressure, you hear the first sound. To determine the diastolic pressure, it is going to be when the sound fades away. So we're hopefully you can get a little bit of experience doing that. If not with your fitness mentor, with potentially your first job when you're hired, or even practice by getting your own blood pressure cuff, as they aren't too expensive. But even nowadays, people are using more electronic blood pressure cuffs, so it's not as common to do it yourself, even though you look pretty cool or look like a doctor when you throw in the stethoscope and are pumping the blood pressure cuff. So let's go ahead and click over to slide 15, and we're going to talk about body composition now. So body composition has to do with the amount of fat compared to lean weight on your body. That's what we care about most as a fitness professional. So there are a variety of methods used to estimate body composition. They vary according to cost, accuracy, and skill needed to perform them. The typical one that's going to be most likely that you will do in the field is going to be skin fold. And the reason why is because it's relatively inexpensive and it is actually pretty dang accurate. And a really good way to use skin fold is to measure the thickness of each skin fold, compare it from first time to the second time or next time, to prove to them that they lost X amount of skin fold millimeters, which means that they are losing body fat. Another way that some gyms do it, I know LA Fitness and Gold Gym, I believe, use bioelectrical impedance, which is going to be like your typical scales that have like the body fat readings or the metal plates on the scales that are going to send an electrical current through your body, and the speed at which that current is sent through your body determines your body fat. Unfortunately, those aren't as accurate and a lot harder to prove that somebody lost body fat, so I'm typically going to stick with the skin fold method. But also, you have the hydrostatic weighing, which most gyms do not do, but it is going to be the gold standard and the closest ability to get as close as possible to your actual body fat percentage. And hydrostatic weighing is it's measuring your body's ability to float underwater. And typically you would only find these in exercise physiology laboratories or where you're doing very, very specific body composition measurements. And I know there's a truck that goes by, I think it's called Brian's Body Fat Testing, at least that's where it is in California, but you can Google a hydrostatic weighing facility, and I think you pay like $50 and go do that to find out very closely what your body fat percentage is. But to tell the truth, skin fold is going to be totally fine because that's actually really accurate. So looking over to slide 16, benefits of body composition. So some benefits of body composition testing are to identify the client's health risk, whether they have too much body fat or too low of body fat. But typically most clients that you're going to be dealing with have too high of body fat. And it's going to help to promote your client's understanding of body fat, because some clients might be skinny, but they might actually have a high body fat percentage. And a high body fat percentage is not as healthy as having a normal body fat percentage. So it's important to differentiate them between being normal weight and high in a body fat body composition and being of normal weight and normal body composition, meaning more muscle. So to help estimate the healthy body weight for clients and athletes, and also is going to assist in program design, if you have a normal weight person that has a high amount of fat on them, they probably aren't going to have too much muscle. So you might potentially want to start them off with lighter weights or easier exercise depending on the client. So looking over to slide 17, the skin fold measurement, this is going to be the most common in the fitness field, and it's effective for trainers without a lab at their disposal. Indirect measure of adipose tissue through thickness of the skin. And basically, if you were to grab your bicep and pull the skin away from the muscle, that would be like a skin fold measure that you might take. And specifically, NASM uses the bicep, the tricep, the subscapular, which is underneath the shoulder blade, and the iliac crest, which is going to be on top of your hip on the right. All of those are on the right side. And that's going to be called the Dernan-Wormersley formula. which we will get into later. But take a minimum of 2 measurements at each site to ensure accuracy and be accurate in locating the same locations during those body fat assessments. Don't measure after exercise, as the sweat might make the calipers slip. And it's really not going to be that effective on someone that is extremely obese, because you know you aren't going to be able to grab a ton of fat. It's more like 30 millimeters or below is going to be the most accurate. So looking over to slide 18, body composition, like I said, the Dernan Wormersley formula, which is the skinfold caliper method, they use 4 sites, which is the biceps, the triceps, the subscapular, and the iliac crest. And Dernan and Wormersley basically were got 2 guys that did a very thorough body fat composition assessment on mostly college-aged males and females. And they chose these 4 sites and related them directly to hydrostatic weighing and came as close as possible to relating their skinfold measurements with their measurements in the underwater weighing. So it is a very accurate test, and they do have a 7 site, which can be actually a little bit more accurate, as the Dernan Wormersley formula does not estimate any lower body fat skinfolds like the 7 site one does. And if you wanted to check your own skinfold if you have calipers, you can go to exrx.net and click on their fitness testing and body composition or skinfold calculator to determine or to fill in a nice little chart that'll tell you directly your body fat percentage via the skinfold method. So let's look at slide 19. Yeah, it's going to go over this test, and this is exactly what you would do in the field. So for slide 19, body fat, you have the biceps, which is a vertical fold on the front of the arm, halfway between the shoulder and the elbow. So yeah, halfway between. It's clicking over to slide 20, you have the triceps, which is a vertical fold on the back of the arm and upper arm, basically in between the shoulder and elbow halfway. And then you have the subscap, which is a 45 degree angle, 1 to 2 centimeters below the inferior angle of the scapula. And those pictures right here are showing you exactly how to pinch. And this one's at a 45 degree angle, as the other ones were at a vertical angle. And most importantly, as they might are most likely to show this one on the test, the body fat iliac crest measurement is going to be just a 45 degree angle just above the iliac crest and medial to the axillary line. So the axillary line, you can imagine as the seam on the side of your shirt, or the armpit going all the way down the direct side of your body. That's the axillary line. And the iliac crest is just medial to that. As you can see, her hand in this picture is on top of the axillary line, and the pinch where he's measuring the skinfold is just medial to that axillary line. So, clicking over to slide 23, body composition, continuing on, calculating body fat percentage. With the Dernan-Wormersley formula, you want to add up the total of all sites, and then you want to use your table in the textbook to find the body fat percentage. So there is a page in your textbook, specifically in the appendix or in chapter 6, that's going to have a chart in which you grab the person's age and their total skin fold amounts and whether they're male or female, and it's going to give you a really good estimate on where their body fat percentage is. But I tend to use the 7 site more, which you can once again go to exrx.net and check out or use their formula to do that with. And you could also just do that right on your phone, and that's why I use it, because what I do is I measure their body fat 7 site, I'll take a picture of their results, and I could text it or email it to them immediately so they know exactly where they're at as far as body fat percentage goes. So looking on to slide 24, you can also do circumference measurements, and the main reason why I do circumference measurements as well would either be for a client that wants to gain muscle size, or a client that's so obese that I wouldn't really want to pinch a ton of fat because it's not really going to be that accurate. So, to read the circumference measurements, another source of feedback used with clients who have the goal of altering body composition is called circumference measurements. This type of body composition method would be best for the clients who are obese. And that is a specific test question that they like to ask is, you know, how can you make an obese client feel comfortable doing body composition? And you can basically do this by using circumference measurements. And the most important factor is going to be consistency, so finding the same spots and measuring the same spots to determine whether they lost inches. And females typically in the field do like to lose inches as they sometimes fit into clothes better and things of that nature. So you take the measurements on the same side of the body each time you test and retest. So if you'd stay on, or you would basically stay on the right side of the body just to keep it even and the same. So clicking over to slide 25, I'm going to quickly go over the sites for body composition testing, and you can look at the pictures further to have a good idea of the way that you can measure these people. So first one is the neck across the Adam's apple. Over to slide 26, we have the chest, which is across the nipple line or the upper chest for women. And moving on to slide 27, you have the navel or the belly button. Typically, I'll tell someone to put their finger in their belly button, and I'll measure just above or just below that. And or you can do the narrowest portion at their waist, which is your choice. Then you have the hips, the widest portion of the hips, or the butt, buttocks, Forrest Gump. And 29, you have the thigh, which is 10 inches above the kneecap. And you can also do the calf, which is at the maximal circumference in between the ankle and the knee. And some people even do the bicep, or upper arm bicep, and that's specific more to someone that might be looking to gain muscle, like in their arms. Oh, I want bigger arms to show off to the ladies, or I want more defined arms, or bigger arms. Then you can measure their circumference of their bicep to see whether they have, or where they're at, so that you can measure it further down the road. So moving on to slide 31, yeah, we also have body mass index. So body mass index does not measure body composition. All it does is assesses someone's weight relative to their height. And the specific formula is going to be kilograms over meters squared. And I believe we went over this in chapter one, and that is going to be important to know that formula. Once again, it's kilograms over meters squared. And basically what you would do is you would convert from pounds to kilograms and then from inches to meters to determine the best way to do that. Or you can use the other formula, the American formula, which is height in inches, or sorry, weight in pounds over height in inches squared multiplied by 703. But they want you to know the metric version, which is going to be kilograms over meters squared. And obesity-related health problems increase when a person's BMI exceeds 25, or they start to get in the overweight category. But you can also have, you know, a very muscular person be in the overweight category without having those same obesity-related health problems because their body composition is low, but their muscle volume is high. Therefore, they might be in the overweight category, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are overweight as far as body composition. And that's the main difference between body mass index and actually testing their body composition. With a very obese client, I might look towards body mass index to get a good measure of and comparison from beginning to end. But typically, I'm going to go with body fat on a normal person, body fat percentage. So clicking over to slide 32, we also have cardiorespiratory assessments. So cardiorespiratory assessments provide valuable information regarding cardiorespiratory efficiency and overall condition. And they provide a starting point for cardiorespiratory training zone specific to their physical condition and goal. And the main two ones that NASM uses is going to be the step test and the Rockport walk test. So I use a cardiorespiratory assessment for mainly my clients that are interested in, if they say, I want to feel better, I want to get healthier, and what does that mean? I want to like feel good. I'm going to put them through a cardiorespiratory assessment to see, you know, how they feel under the stress of exercise. If it's a big struggle for them, we know that they need to really improve to feel better. And or if it's like an endurance athlete or someone that, hey, you know, I'm training for a marathon, that's when I might put someone through a cardiorespiratory assessment. And the two, once again, are step test and Rockport walk test. So let's look at them both. So the step test is going to be you're stepping for 3 minutes straight. And it could be called the YMCA step test or the 3 minute step test. But you're going to be stepping for 3 minutes straight and measuring the recovery heart rate immediately after that. But specifically to point something out, before the test, determine the client's maximum heart rate by subtracting the client's age from the number 220. 220 minus age. And that's a test question that they like to use is what should you do before you perform the 3 minute step test? You should determine the client's maximum heart rate by subtracting the client's age from the number 220. So, to look a little bit further down, take a maximum heart rate and multiply it by the following figures to determine the heart rate ranges for each zone. And what you're going to do is then measure the recovery heart rate. So when we click over to slide 34, the step test, it says perform the 3-minute step test by having a client do 24 steps per minute on a 12-inch step. And this is what I would do if I don't have a treadmill. But typically in most gyms, you are going to have a treadmill at hand. But if you don't, what you need is a metronome and a timer and show them how to do 24 steps per minute, which 24 steps per minute would be the metronome 90 seconds.